Hi, this is Dan Aronson, host of Press One for Democracy. Thanks for joining us tonight. Before we get on with tonight's show, I'd like to talk to you about a new coffee party action. Well, actually, it's a potential action. Last Wednesday, the board of directors unanimously voted to come out against the lack of transparency under which the TPP has been created and is being negotiated. A blog has been posted on our main coffee party website at www.coffeepartyusa.com. The blog also points out that President Obama has said that he is going to invoke fast track, which limits the amount of discussion and any amendments to the actual treaty during the process of congressional confirmation. On December 18th, we will send out a ballot to our membership, allowing you to vote yay or nay as to whether we should come out officially against the lack of transparency the TPP is being negotiated under. In the meantime, there is also a petition that you can sign, which will allow you to both tweet and post to your Facebook accounts your reaction to the TPP. We at the Coffee Party thank you for all you do, your activism, and your engaged citizenry. And now, on with tonight's show. Good evening, everyone, and welcome to another edition of Press One for Democracy. This is your host, Dan Aronson, reporting back in after taking the week off. I was actually in Florida last week on business and had an engagement during the normal time of the show. Being on East Coast time, things just didn't work out for me. Here on the West Coast, I'm in a lot more control of my hours, so I am happy to be back and happy to be bringing you a show on my latest and greatest topic that I love to rant about, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, also known as the TPP. We talk about it a lot in this show, and I wanted to dedicate an entire show to talking about the TPP, the evils of the TPP, and really start getting people's feedback on whether this should be a core issue that the Coffee Party takes up a position stance on, and of course, I would be pushing for the position stance of against for the many reasons that we will hopefully discuss here and that will unfold over the next hour and a half to 2 hours, depending on our callers, of course, because this is a call-in show. This is your chance to have your voice heard across the internet, across the World Wide Web, could be going anywhere in the world, could be heard by anybody in the world, and this is your opportunity. It's your dime. It's your dance floor. So please, if you want to voice your opinion on the TPP, on anything relative to the TPP, on issue stance, on secrecy, on the people that are lining up against the TPP, and I find that to be highly interesting as to who exactly is lining up against the TPP, considering who is driving the TPP. So, you know, any of those topics, you know, love to hear your opinions on them. And the number to call in is 646-929-2495. And when you get into the host queue, then you hit, the nice British lady will tell you to hit 1, and that will raise your little electronic hand on my keyboard, and I will then be able to bring you into the conversation. So, yeah, let's talk about the TPP, and let's talk about, there's really two things, there's really two areas as far as I'm concerned that we really need to concentrate on. So one is how the TPP is being created, how it's being negotiated, and then the substance of it as well. So those are two different things, two different areas of concern, both equally scary as far as I'm concerned. And so we want to talk about those very specific topics. And we want to see how things are shaking out, not only in the court of public opinion, what are the experts saying, what are the activists saying, but what are the actual players saying? And by players, I mean, of course, the politicians, those folks in Washington, D.C., who, if you take this at a glance, Anybody pro-TPP is pro-big corporation, pro-big money. There are no two ways about it. Although, again, if somebody wants to explain to me how I'm wrong, I'm always happy to listen, always happy to learn. Just be, you know, mindful of the coffee party way, which is to be fact-based. So make sure to bring your sources. And then, of course, be civil and be open to listening to other opinions. That's what the coffee party is all about. That is the way we act, and that is those are our stated principles. So we obviously have to follow those. Now, as far, though, as issue stances are concerned, the coffee party has taken up three particular issue stances. And again, all of this you could find at www.coffeepartyusa on our main, right up our main website. Go to About Us, and then you will see mission statement. Go to the mission statement, and you will be able to read about the way we comport ourselves and what we're actually interested in discussing. So right now, the main coffee party issues that have been decided are, one, get money out of politics. Obviously, that's number one with a bullet. We are also interested in reforming the tax code. So that's number two. And of course, we have come out firmly against, and obviously it doesn't really need to be said, anything as far as voter suppression. We are obviously against the voter suppression laws that are coming into play. Right now, our president, Eric Beiler, is off with his partner, Annabelle Park, award-winning filmmakers, creating a documentary about the voter suppression that's taking place, or the laws that are coming to fruition in North Carolina, and about the battle taking place there. And it's an incredibly interesting topic. I understand that that they've kind of got their first draft. I believe the phraseology in the business is in the can. So I guess they're going on to editing phases, but if somebody wanted to call in and discuss that as well, that would be fine. But the question again tonight is the TPP. How is it being conducted? How is it being drafted? And so instead of having me just sitting here telling you all about it, let me read you some of the things that just little bits and pieces and clips that I've been taking from various articles. And I'll start by just basically the setup that I gave the show for this evening. Progressive Democrats Elizabeth Warren, Massachusetts, and Ron Wyden, both senators, of course, are leading a coalition of 68 Democrats and one Republican that has openly come out against the president's total lack of transparency on the Trans-Pacific Partnership, more commonly known, referred to as the TPP. The American people and even members of Congress are being denied access to the contents of this massive 29-chapter agreement. Yet representatives from corporations such as Halliburton, Monsanto, Chevron, and Walmart are helping to actually write and negotiate it. In an open letter written to the president, Senator Warren said, "I have heard the argument that transparency would undermine the administration's policy to complete the trade agreement because public opposition would be significant. This argument is exactly backwards. If transparency would lead to widespread public opposition to a trade agreement, then that trade agreement should not be the policy of the United States. I believe in transparency and democracy, and I think the U.S. trade representative should too." And I'm going to go ahead and cut and paste the link to the entire text of the letter from Senator Warren into the chat room, so those of you listening online can actually go read at your own leisure. There you go. The full letter. But I mean, you know, it, for her to even have to say that, just kind of, I guess for lack of a better term, blows me away. I mean, think about what the people who are negotiating this in total secrecy are saying. Well, if it came out, if the details came out, the American people would be outraged. They would be opposed to significantly opposed to the treaty. So we're going to keep it secret from you. I mean, I can't be the only one that just boggles my mind that had to be said. So what they're saying is real simple. It's like, we know you're not going to like this. As a matter of fact, we know you're going to hate it. So we're just not going to tell you about it. And then we'll go ahead and fast track it, and we can talk about fast tracking as well, because that is the president's idea of how he wants to put this through. Fast tracking being a process by which the treaty would go through Congress with very limited discussion, no possibility of amendments, and it would just basically be an up or down vote. So I'm not going to tell you what's in it, and because I know you're going to be mad at me, and I'm going to just shove it right through Congress. And I'm not going to let those guys get their hands on it and start making all kinds of changes. So it's just going to go through. And the president said in the State of the Union address earlier this year, it was a significant and high priority for him to get this done by the end of the year. Now, of course, that puts us about 30 days away, probably more like 10 or 15 legislative days away. So it doesn't really look like that's going to happen. However, we still need to stand up, and we need to understand what this is. We need to understand what the ramifications are, and we need to understand that this is a government that it is just one of the biggest end runs around the legislative process and around democracy that we've ever seen in the history of our country. And the impact of this is huge. So other folks who come out against it, a guy I always brag on here on this show, my senator from Oregon, Senator Ron Wyden, said on the floor, he said, the majority of Congress is being kept in the dark as to the substance of the TPP negotiations, while representatives of U.S. corporations like Halliburton, Chevron, Pharma, Comcast, and the Motion Picture Association of America are being consulted and made privy to the details of the agreement. It's not bad enough that the President of the United States has instructed his treaty team to create this document and push this through Congress, but he's then gone ahead and he has consulting with 600 corporate consultants, and these guys are they get to see it. Of course, they get to see it. They're writing it, and that's just kind of blows me away. And I can only imagine that it has to be a matter of that we just – people aren't talking about it. It's certainly not getting press other than in the activist newsletters and blogs. It just kind of blows me away. While in other countries, significant protests have been going on specific to the transparency issue, and people are demanding to be heard. So there are other members of Congress that have weighed in on this. Representative Alan Grayson from Florida's 9th District called the TPP a punch in the face to middle-class America. Representative Keith Ellison, a Democrat from Minnesota, described it as the largest corporate power grab you've never heard of. And again, I think that underscores the point of the need to get this information out and to get it out into the mainstream and to have discussion around it and to inevitably, if nothing else, force the government to be transparent about this. And that's exactly what Elizabeth Warren is saying. She says, I believe in transparency, and I think that the U.S. trade representative should too. So all this is kind of juxtaposed to what the president said way back in 2009, just after he had been elected and sworn in. He made a speech that is, you know, really his intention obviously was to set the tone for how his administration was going to handle such delicate matters of potentially of national security, but certainly of highly confidential information. And I want to play that clip for you. It's a short little two-minute clip here. This is President Obama back in 2009 speaking on transparency.
But the way to make a government responsible is not simply to enlist the services of responsible men and women or to sign laws that ensure that they never stray. The way to make government responsible is to hold it accountable. And the way to make government accountable is to make it transparent so that the American people can know exactly what decisions are being made, how they're being made, and whether their interests are being well served. The directives I am giving my administration today on how to interpret the Freedom of Information Act will do just that. For a long time now, there's been too much secrecy in this city. The old rules said that if there was a defensible argument for not disclosing something to the American people, then it should not be disclosed. That era is now over. Starting today, every agency and department should know that this administration stands on the side not of those who seek to withhold information, but those who seek to make it known. To be sure, issues like personal privacy and national security must be treated with the care they demand. But the mere fact that you have the legal power to keep something secret does not mean you should always use it. The Freedom of Information Act is perhaps the most powerful instrument we have for making our government honest and transparent, and of holding it accountable. And I expect members of my administration not simply to live up to the letter, but also the spirit of this law. I will also hold myself as president to a new standard of openness. Going forward, anytime the American people want to know something that I or a former president wants to withhold, we will have to consult with the Attorney General and the White House counsel, whose business it is to ensure compliance with the rule of law. Information will not be withheld just because I say so. It will be withheld because a separate authority believes my request is well-grounded in the Constitution. Let me say it as simply as I can. Transparency and the rule of law will be the touchstones of this presidency.
I love that last clause. I love that last sentence he says. Transparency and the rule of law will be the touchstones of this presidency. Now, here we are 5 years later. We've had all of the NSA snooping. We've had all of the NDAA provisions with and all of the other infringements on civil liberty. And the president obviously thinks he has met his standard of proving that certain entities within the government, or certain entities within his, I should say, advisors, and the Attorney General, have decided that, you know what, it's okay. Well, everything we're doing is okay. It's okay we snoop on you. It's okay that we threaten to hold you indefinitely as a citizen of the United States. Well, that's okay. Okay, so you could argue, I suppose you could argue, national security issues merit that kind of secrecy. But this is not a matter of national security, folks. This is a trade agreement. Right. This is not something that is defining criminal acts. This is not something that is defining, where it's sussing out imminent threats to our security. This is not an anti-terrorism bill or an anti-terrorism policy. This is a trade agreement being negotiated 100% in secrecy by a president who said that transparency and the rule of law will be a touchstone of his presidency. And it just doesn't add up, folks, unless the president has fallen to big money, unless the president is having his strings pulled by big money. Now, obviously, that's an if. I said if. And again, if anybody wants to call and discuss it with me, you can do so at 646-929-2495. And I'm happy to do so. But when you look at past the transparency issue and you look at the actual issues that are being leaked, and remember, this is being done in total secrecy, so what we do know about the TPP, the specifics, whatever we do know, have been leaked. One of them was by a U.S. congressman, as a matter of fact, who posted the entire section on intellectual property, which covers a couple of different things. First, it covers what was in the SOPA bill that was soundly defeated in Congress the day that Congress and big money ran into bigger money. And let's not for a second kid ourselves into thinking that SOPA was defeated because the people rose up in great number. SOPA was defeated, if you will remember, because Google and other internet giants went on strike and said, you know what, we are not stand for this. We will take the internet down, and there will just be no more internet. And they did it by basically doing an internet blackout for an hour. And all of a sudden, something to the tune of 60-plus votes in Congress changed within that hour, and so it was soundly defeated. So, you know, unfortunately, this was not the people rising up. This was just big money with one interest trumping big money with another interest. However, it was defeated. And the point is that the intellectual property laws that are being put into place through this treaty, not passed by law, not passed by the regular legislative process, basically enforce, and Ron Wyden himself has spoke out against this. I know because I was at a lunch here at the City Club in Portland when he said they're basically trying to ram everything that was in SOPA through, but in the form of this treaty, and make it just as enforceable as if it was passed through Congress. And he said he did not plan on standing for that. So that's just one of the things. Now, the second thing is the intellectual property laws and regulations chapter speak to patent protection, and very specifically to patent protection on drugs. Right? So everybody knows the fact that the reason why Big Pharma makes so much money is because they will go in, they will invent a drug, and they will get to patent it. And that patent will last for X number of years, and then they actually get to apply for secondary patents. This is a great trick. So secondary patents, so the primary patents are on the actual formula of the drug itself. The secondary patents actually can be anything from how it's used, how it's dispensed. It could be the color. So that little blue pill, right? The little blue pill, guess what? They can apply for a patent on the blue pill. So if you have if you want to come out with a competing ED drug against Viagra, sorry, yours can't be blue. It's got to be a different color. So they use these secondary patents to extend the life of their initial patents, and these things now last 20 years or more. And of course, as long as there's a patent, there's no competition, and as long as there's no competition, they can keep the drug prices high. But here is the worst part of it, and that is if you look at just think of the drug commercials you see on television, right? Sleep aids, weight loss aids, hair loss, fighting hair loss products that fight hair loss, erectile dysfunction, depression, you know, all things that people suffer from, granted. And, of course, we can achieve better life through chemistry. But because that is where the profit is in the drug industry, what isn't being researched? Drugs to cure cancer, drugs to cure AIDS, drugs to cure childhood diabetes, you know, actual diseases that are plaguing the world, right? And we have to remember, too, that we're lucky to live in a country where we have these kinds of advanced drugs and advanced treatments, if you can afford them. But when you go outside the country, how are those people getting treated? How are people in Africa getting treated for AIDS if they don't have money? Well, that's the whole point. And with the extension of patents, especially on AIDS treatments, a low-cost AIDS cure or AIDS retardant cannot be produced. It just can't be done. So, I mean, that the damage it's doing to the health of the world by incenting these drug companies to just go after the highly profitable drugs is terrible. And it will extend, they say, into the insurance industry. Once the borders are down and insurance companies can go out and start creating policies in other countries, they will tend to go after the high-end policies, and that will, of course, reduce the total overall pool, and it will basically bastardize the ability of the insured pool to offset low risk versus high risk, and it will drive the cost of insurance up. So all of these things, again, just basically by being able to extend intellectual property rights that once again were defeated in Congress, are now being put into this this trade agreement, and they're going to, at least the president's intention is to push it through. So it's interesting, I think, when you look at the opposition, because the people lining up behind Elizabeth Warren, 68 Democrats, one Republican. And I'm not sure how the Republicans snuck on there or who he knew or who he was good friends with, but 68 Democrats are now telling the President of the United States, this is wrong, this is bad, and you have to minimally tell the people about it. So with that, I want to take a pause for the cause. Still looking for my first caller. Again, this is it's a call-in radio show, and as I always like to say, nobody wants to hear me yap for an hour. I don't even want to hear me yap for an hour. So if you want to go ahead and call 646-929-2495 and discuss anything on the TPP, would love to hear from you. Just so you know, of course, this is not the only Coffee Party radio show that's available during the week. As a matter of fact, we now have five Coffee Party radios. We've added a new one, and I don't have the particulars on the new show. I didn't get the memo. Maybe it came out last week, but I can talk to you about it. But, of course, this show, Press One for Democracy, is heard every Monday night starting at 6 p.m. Pacific Time, 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. And it is then followed in the week on Tuesdays with The Middle Ground with the host Eric Beiler and a host of co-hosts that come down the pipe. And that starts at 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, 5 p.m. Pacific Time on Tuesdays. On Thursdays, we have Lunch with Loudon, with Janine Loudon. And Janine's on at noon Pacific Time, 3 p.m. Eastern Standard Time every Thursday. And that is followed by Egberto Willis, who does Politics Done Right, and that is on Saturdays starting at 1 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, 10 p.m. Pacific Time. And then now we have the new our new Sunday show, which is Progressive Politics Tennessee. And I see that the new host has joined me, so maybe he'll even pop on here and talk. We can talk a little bit about his show. I did not get to hear it Sunday because I was in transit, but I would love to to chat with the gentleman that does that and get the details on his show. So if you want to call in and give a little promo plug, be perfect time for it. Right now, I recognize number 724, Mr. Greg Russick, to the rescue, because I'm already going hoarse and getting out of breath here, boss. What's going on, Greg?
How you doing, Dan? Great. This is a great topic, obviously, to be talking about. It's really important, and you're right. It doesn't seem to be getting nearly enough attention yet. Although, since Elizabeth Warren has taken up the mantle, I suspect that that will change and change rapidly. At least I hope so. I would have to agree.
I mean, it's always good when you can lead out that you're supporting Elizabeth Warren on a Coffee Party show and on the Coffee Party blog, because you know everybody loves her, and for good reason. I mean, you know, obviously she's a great lady. A lot of people are talking about her for 2016. I mean, let's face it, if you're forward thinking and you're a Democrat, then she's one of the couple of names that are always bandied about, and it's time to start looking at that. So yeah, I mean, she's a great ally. It's good to be on the same side of the argument with her. Let's say that.
Wait, you leveraged the brand real well to attract a crowd, so that's always a good idea too. So, hey, I was curious to know if you know what the defenders of the TPP are saying that will be a positive outcome out of any of this. I haven't heard any of that at this point. I've only been following the "we shouldn't do this" part. Do you know? I mean, besides perhaps the idea that free trade is somehow always good, although I've got some data here that says obviously that's not the case. Do you know?
Well, I'd love to hear that. I will tell you that you have to comb through it, right, with the proverbial fine-tooth comb to find positive stuff being said about the TPP. The one clip I had found, and this was quite some time ago, and perhaps I should have queued it up out of fairness, but the one clip I had found was actually from one of the original It was a Senate session where they were interviewing the folks that were looking at that they were looking at putting in charge of the TPP. And one of the congressmen said something. He said something to the effect exactly what you said. Free trade is good. Free trade is always good. We are addressing the countries that are involved in this represent 40% of the gross national product of the world, and we will be opening our markets to that, or we'll be opening their markets to us, and therefore we can expand our trade within these areas. And that was pretty much it. More new markets for us.
And there's actually a counterfactual argument to that. Now, I found this article on Truthout. It comes from July this past year. I can put the link in the chat room to it a little bit later. Let me see if I can find that paragraph now that I just said that, because I scrolled to the top to get the date of the article. Darn it. So here it is. 2012 trade data revealed that for countries with which the U.S. has a trade agreement, the trade deficit increased by 440%. At the same time, the trade deficit decreased slightly for countries with which the U.S. does not have a trade agreement. And the U.S. already has trade agreements that cover 90% of the GDP of the countries involved in the TPP. So to me, that shoots a real 440% hole in that argument that to have a trade agreement is good for us, because it data shows it has increased the trade deficit with those countries by 440%.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And that's the thing. When you look at it on balance, sure, they're opening their borders to us. So you could, if you just look at it or if you don't look at it as a zero-sum game and you only look at one side of the equation, that sounds great. But we're opening our borders to them. And who, pray tell, consumes more? And I will tell you the answer really quickly. We consume more than all of the other countries in the trade agreement combined.
Yeah, right. Well, here's some more interesting information out of this same article. You bear with me, it's really quick too.
No, go ahead.
Not only does deregulated trade harm the environment by allowing corporations to settle where environmental laws are the most lax and making new laws difficult to pass, but it leads to hundreds of thousands of jobs leaving the U.S. The TPP is often referred to as NAFTA on steroids. It is estimated that close to 700,000 jobs were lost from the U.S. due to NAFTA alone. The TPP will make it easier for transnational corporations to relocate where labor is the cheapest, which drives down wages and working conditions for everyone. Free trade agreements escalate wealth inequality worldwide.
Well, and I think that last one, there is the point. And so, of course, I mean, why did Detroit go bankrupt? I don't know how many thousands of U.S. auto jobs went south, to the northern areas of Mexico right as soon as NAFTA was signed. I mean, they started building plants there like crazy. Now Detroit's bankrupt. Correlation? I'm guessing yes. But I think, the key thing, I think, is what you just said. Who is going to have the ability to take advantage of new markets in new foreign markets? Small businesses? Probably not. Megacorps? You bet.
Absolutely.
If there is benefit, it's for those at the top. It's for big oil. It's for big pharma. It's for big retail. It's for manufacturing, what's a little left of our manufacturing sector. It is all for those guys. They're the ones who will benefit from this. Joe's hardware store on the corner, they're not going to benefit from this. Mary's hair salon, she's not going to. They're not going to benefit from this.
Right.
I mean, it's crazy. As a matter of fact, what's going to happen is it's going to be – not only does it make it easy to export jobs, but it makes it easy for foreign nationals to get into this country and set up businesses – competing right down the corner from Joe's hardware store and competing right down the corner from Mary's salon, and they will have carte blanche to import resources, not just people, well, I mean people as well, and resources to run their businesses from where it's cheaper. I don't know. Yeah, I mean, so when it comes time to, you know, anybody saying this is a good thing, I can't figure it. I can't figure it.
So you know, one of the takeaways for me in all this, and kind of the, you know, just some walking around knowledge that we as average citizens need to have, you know, should somebody ask questions as to why we should be in opposition, how come we hate everything that, you know, is advantageous to big corporations. You know, I get that one occasionally. You know, it's, why are you so anti-corporate? And I'm not. I'm all about making sure that, though, that we don't put a set of policies, and in this case, trade agreements in place that allow for the race to the bottom to occur, such that corporate balance sheets look great because all of us have been royally screwed. That, you know, we are now in a global market in which, as this article points out, an organization no longer sees borders. And we've talked about this before. Multinational corporations don't recognize boundaries and borders. They're simply markets to be pursued and to be dominated. And as a capitalist, I don't have a problem with that in principle, so long as it's done without doing damage to people, to societies, to culture, to the environment. It doesn't have to be one or the other. They're not mutually exclusive. We can have a capitalist system that doesn't kill the planet and kill people, so long as corporations are willing to recognize that they might not be able to squeeze every last dime out of every last market. Profits might not be maximized, but at least everybody gets a little bit. And I think that's the concept and the principle that seems to be missing in so much of this.
I totally agree with you. And it is a turning of the corner that I think we all on this show that are regular participants, you know, we point back to the beginning of the trickle-down economics and when the disparity between CEO pay and average Joe pay went from 66%, I think, in the 60s to where it's now like 400%. And yeah, I mean, it was the go-go 80s. It was the me. What's in it for me? Me. How do I maximize my dollars?
Right.
How do I maximize my cents?
Right.
And who do I have to step on to climb up the corporate ladder? And that mentality is what got these people to the top of the chain. And you know, they're now doing anything they need to make sure that they stay there, which includes, of course, the buying of our government, the purchasing of our government, to make sure that things like the TPP get pushed through so that they can continue to make money. And I think some of these people are so out of it, or are so their greed has so pushed them over the top that I believe that they think by the time they're done squeezing every penny out of the earth, we'll have somehow colonized Mars or something, and we'll just go to Mars and we'll just do it all over again. I don't know.
You know what? I'd believe that if we were, Dan, I would believe that as a possibility if we were actually funding the space program, but we're not.
Well, you won't have to, Greg. There won't be private. There won't be public. But what there will be is there'll be private companies that will start building private rockets to go do space exploration for profit. That's what's going to happen. And that might sound far-fetched, but does it? I mean, think about it. We've already got the rich people building private schools, building gated communities with their own security. So who needs police? I've got gated communities with my own security. I can hire my own, you know, guys from Halliburton, and I can, you know, or who was that, Black? What was it? Who are the guys they hired
Blackwater?
Blackwater, right, I'll just hire a bunch of guys from Blackwater. I'll do my own personal thing. I don't need anybody else because I've got all the money. And with I got all the money, I can build anything I want. And eventually, it's private spaceships for exploration. I mean, they already do it to a point, right? I mean, there's private programs out there that are putting satellites, GPS satellites, and all kinds of other things for profit.
Well, actually, they're resupplying the space station.
Exactly.
What's the name of that company? It's in I can't remember the name of it now.
But we have another caller who wants to join in. 410, is that Maryland? I used to know them all. 410, your microphone is open. Whom do we have the pleasure of speaking with?
Hi, this is Alan.
Hi, Alan. Okay? How are you? Where are you calling from?
Columbia, Maryland.
It was Maryland. I got it right.
Yeah.
Yay. Yeah. Yay for not having totally lost my memory. What do you think about this TPP mess, Alan?
Well, I'm a science kind of fella, but I don't. I'm not an anti-capitalist, but I am. Very worried about the income disparity going on in the country.
Absolutely, it's one of my favorite books. I read beginning of this year was The Price of Inequality by Joseph Stiglitz, and what income disparity and wealth disparity does to a society as a whole, and it paints a pretty grim picture.
Right. I agree. So I'm not so upset about people making money, but I am upset that a large chunk of the population has none. And I could give you solutions. I think I know what to do. I know how
please,
to make
please,
the economy
please.
Better.
Please, please, we love those on this show.
Well, magnetically levitated trains would be a great way to send things into orbit.
Okay, you had me, but you lost me.
Okay, a magnetically levitated train can be used to be a launcher for a space vehicle.
Okay.
But if we put our money into that sort of stuff, then you can create millions of jobs.
Ah, okay. Now, who puts the money into it? Who does the R&D?
If the private sector doesn't want to build this, the government should. The people should. The R&D for lots of stuff is government funded. And then private enterprise rakes in the profits from all the money spent in R&D on lots of things, don't they?
Absolutely. The drug industry is a particular good user of NIH and other government-funded health research. Absolutely.
Right. So we shouldn't tolerate an argument that some so-called private entrepreneur stuck his capital into something and he's entitled to reap 100% of the profits of everything that he accomplishes with that investment. That is a very sour argument. It literally disrespects every person that's ever lived that has contributed to the getting humanity this far.
Well, that's the point that Stiglitz makes in his book. He talks about the people who went into research for the good of humanity, people like Jonas Salk. You know, there was no money in curing polio, but
right.
He decided that it was important enough to do it. You know, and I think culturally and philosophically, we turned a corner at some point. I mean, if you think about the birth of the country and you think about people would come over here with, you know, with a few bucks in their pocket, they'd do well, and then what would they do? They'd send back for their family, right? And they would join these societies within their own, like, you know, typically within their own either racial or ethnic origin, right? And they'd have the society of Chinese and the society of – and they reach back and they'd help. Where did that go? When did we quit giving a damn about other people in this country?
I can tell from my experience, it's sort of along the lines of what you just said. I didn't grow up in Maryland. I grew up in Massachusetts. And my family was French-Canadian. And back then, when I was a teenager, youngster, the culture of the community was something much different from now. And the tool I have to highlight that difference is to give you a picture of what our dining room table looked like for Thanksgiving. The turkey was not the centerpiece. You know what the centerpiece was?
No.
It was called a horn of plenty or a cornucopia.
Ah, right.
It was a wicker basket shaped like a horn with a bunch of waxed fruit jammed in it. And you were considered a cretin if culturally, if you didn't have one of these things in your house. It could have been the wicker basket, or it could have been a brass ornament, or it could have been a ceramic thing. But this idea of abundance, the potential of the human endeavor to bring forth something, was part of the culture. And along came the population bomb, and they scared everybody to death with this Malthusian crap. And they said, oh, you're going to outstrip the resources of the planet. So they shut down industry. They shut down protective tariffs. Wall Street took over. They killed JFK. I mean, I don't want to sound like someone who's got a shtick by bringing up JFK. But it is the anniversary of his murder in a few days. So this just happens to be on my mind. Kennedy
was a person
that was fighting for economic development for the whole world. You know what I mean?
Right. And we had a show a couple weeks ago on what was the last piece of legislation was passed strictly to help the poor people of this country. And my recollection was, I believe it was Kennedy's war on poverty and the beginning of welfare. It was the first time. Now, it wasn't, as they said in the movie Taps, it was maybe the wrong execution of the right idea, but at least it was the right idea.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, and then they said, well, we can't have any of this now, can we? So he has to go. And there he went.
But if you want to have a context, President JFK was not the only leader murdered in those days. People were being shot left and right all over the world. Happened to, for 10 years straight.
Yeah.
And
no,
we lost this
right
idea
too.
Of the cornucopia, and in its place was put in this Malthusian outlook.
Help me understand what you mean by that.
Yeah,
Malthusian,
the
population
Malthusian
explosion. Population increases geometrically while the resources only increase arithmetically. That's how they present it. But it's a lie. It's actually the opposite. And you know what? It seems to me that you can have an academic and intellectual discourse about such things, but at the end of the day, bad turn of phrase, ultimately you have to take a leap of faith, because all of the parts of your internal mindset, call it a hypothesis, call it a axiomatic base, whatever it is, the parts of the ingredients that you use for your thinking, your logic, they're all congruent. What you extrapolate from all your axiomatic basis is still congruent with your assumptions. So if you want to prove that Malthus is right, you can. But all of that logic is incongruent with the other guy's thinking that, Shakespeare's The Undiscovered Country, that sort of thing. Something much different from Malthus.
Well, philosophy is philosophy, and that's all fine and well. But to me, it's where does the rubber meet the road?
You have to take a leap of faith. Yeah.
Well, that's it, and I think that's where I come back to my favorite phrase that I've ever coined. I try to coin phrases in like good bumper sticker ones, and sometimes they're a little too long. This one's a little too long, but it really comes down to this: capitalism without conscience is the greatest form of tyranny, and we are living that we are living the life that proves that undeniably.
Sure.
These people have at the top have – well, and not everybody. I won't say everybody does, because there are corporations that do caring things, and there are corporations that do a lot of good philanthropic work. I mean, they're not all bad. But then there are the ones who are not only – they're not only consumed with jacking profits up, and I think Big Oil is maybe one of my faves. I mean, you know, they go, they make so much money, and if they want to make more money, they just turn up the price of gas or, you know, the heating oil or whatever it is, or they choke off supply. They do what they do whatever they need to do, and then they're happy that they show up in front of Congress every year and say, but we're poor and we don't have any money, so you've got to give us these big $4 billion, $5 billion in subsidies because we'll go broke. You know, says Exxon, who made $22 billion in profit in 2012. And it's how disconnected does your ethics center of your brain have to be to make that argument?
Again,
and
but it's,
these
and
people
it's axiomatic.
Are writing the TPP.
In their own
They're
minds.
Writing the TPP. These people are writing the TPP. The
sure,
Montanos
but
of the
think
world,
of it.
who want to pump all kinds of chemicals into the food supply, the big pharma, who is just reaping huge benefits off of the patent laws, and I mean it seems beyond.
But think of how these people, the axiomatic base for everything they think about is Malthusian. In other words, if you can prove that everything's a zero sum game, then you justify theft, you can justify murder,
right.
You can justify all kinds of things.
That's right.
But if you can prove that no, the universe is an ever expanding, blossoming thing, something novelty is where it's at. Something new is always being created. Then you cannot justify theft. You cannot justify murder. You can,
well,
you know, they're,
but
they're
they
clever. They don't call it theft and murder, but it is.
Right.
But they can. The people at the top, the ones who are going to benefit from this, they can. I mean, and here's the thing. You can talk about patent protection. You can talk about a lot of different things. Here's the one clause that is absolutely makes no sense to me. Right, because now if you think about the way that this country came out of the Depression, right? We came out of the Depression primarily on the backs of Roosevelt's New Deal, which the centerpiece was the public works program, right? The government went out and just said, hey, we've got to hire a lot of people. We're going to build roads. We're going to build national parks and all kinds of other cool things for the benefit of everybody, and we're going to put America back to work, and we're going to give these people skills training. I mean, that in very large part, you know, that obviously and then the war, but that it was in very large part. And one of the things that came out of that was the Buy American program, where it was stated that government agencies will give preferential preferential purchasing to American companies.
Sure.
Right? It makes sense, right? Those things have been in place and still are in place today. I know I do a lot of business with the government, and, you know, the company I work for is Canadian, and guess what? I mean, it's like they always look at you, well, I don't know if we've got an American company that's doing the same thing and it's around the same price, we're going to buy their stuff. I hear that all the time. The TPP will get rid of this. The TPP will put an end to Buy American.
Right. I'm very glad you guys are causing such a ruckus about we need to fight the TPP. Sure. That's why I called you guys, because I got some email telling me, you know, giving me the heads up about it. But hey,
this website
for the healthcare.org? It's being run by a Canadian company.
Yep.
Now, how do you like them apples?
I thought that was very interesting. I will never understand why they were chosen or how they were chosen. You know.
But the reason I called is I wanted to add some meat to your discussion. Because if you look at what the opposition to FDR was throughout that whole time, you'll see the same power structures in play today. And it's literally the same power structures that were responsible for killing JFK. Because John Kennedy wanted to do the same thing that FDR had done.
Yep. And FDR came for money. And he gathered his friends, he gathered his rich buddies out in that city, that suburb of New York that they all lived in, and said, "I'm going to take all your money, by the way. I'm going to push income tax rates up to 96% for the wealthy. I'm going to take all your money, but it's going to be good in the end. It's going to hurt for a while, but in the end, the country's going to come out of this. We're going to be more prosperous and wealthy.
And you'll make more money than you ever thought you could."
Yeah, exactly. And he did it, and it worked.
Yeah.
And, then Kennedy says, "Oh, I'm going to do the same thing." No. Now, President Obama ran on a lot of pledges about putting the middle class back to work. He then went and pushed for the saving of Detroit and the big three automakers. And, he got a little bit of play out of that. But the Congress isn't going to let him do that. And meanwhile, the tax rates are still as low as they've been on the upper percentages. And I'm sorry, that's got to change.
What's the missing ingredient? The rank and file. We don't have the rank and file that FDR did. We don't have the rank and file that JFK did.
So here's what I'm going to say to you. Yes, we do. But they figured out how to defeat us. And that is by divide and conquer. So they keep throwing the most divisive issues out there and making sure that the conversation are on the most divisive issues so that left v. right and red v. blue are at each other's throats. Well, how can we come together and become that rank and file? And it wasn't just FDR. It was Teddy, too, right? I mean, because Teddy had to clean up the mess, right? I mean, he had to come in there, and, I mean, you talk about a guy who really fought against corporatocracy and who really fought against crony capitalism. That was the guy, and he did it by taking his ideas to the American people, right?
I know all about it. I grew up in Massachusetts.
Well, there you go. But we're too busy fighting each other. They've got us fighting each other, and if we cannot temporarily, I'd like to see it be more than temporary, put down our swords and quit waging this new civil war, then we can come together and we can be the rank and file and we can get money out of Washington.
Increase
tax rates on the top, and we can get people back to work, and we create jobs and recreate the middle class, raise 80% of the America is for raising the minimum wage.
I'm with you 100%, and I know what to do. I have
okay,
the answer. I have the solution.
I'm listening.
Well,
we're going to go to you next.
We need a united front. And since everybody's getting hammered by budget cuts, we might as well call it a united front against austerity. And we have such an organization. And we are promoting the 1% Wall Street sales tax. Because Wall Street is making money hand over fist while everyone else is being thrown in the ditch. And if there is $1.7 quadrillion of turnover on Wall Street every year, 1% is $17 trillion. That would put the national debt to rest in 1 year if we choose to do so.
I love it. Alan, you got a website.
United Front Against Austerity is at againstausterity.org. And the Tax Wall Street Party is at taxwallstreetparty.org. And we are forming chapters nationally. Many of the people on Twitter that fight against the TPP know exactly who we are and what we're doing. And you might have them give us a good nod.
Well, let me do this for you before I move on to 931. So besides being a coffee party radio host, I'm also on the board of directors. I would like to have some offline time to chat with you about your organization, learn more about it. And coffee party is all about endorsing people who are about unification and about making things right for every American, not just for those at the top.
Coffee party website, gee whiz, 1 week after it was up, was back in 2009 almost? Is that when you guys started?
I should know my history better than that.
2008,
Greg, you know,
maybe?
When we started? That sounds about right.
It sounds about right.
Yeah.
Yeah. I honestly didn't come on board till like 2011, so I'm kind of a late-to-the-party guy, but I'm making up for it. Or at least I'm trying. Alan, it's been an absolute pleasure.
Joseph Pack doesn't understand a lot of the stuff that we need him to, but he does understand his neck is on the line. And if you need to unify the people that are getting cut from Medicaid or Medicare or Social Security, and you need to unify them with people that are losing their wages and fighting for union rights, and if you need to unify all of these economic, these little grouplets, get them all recognizing their own self-interest is in forming a new political party to tax Wall Street.
I absolutely hear you. I'm all about it. Alan, thank you very, very much. That was fantastic. Fantastic ideas, and I'm glad we got your message out there and your organizational out there. Greg, thoughts before we move on to 931?
I'm really glad he called in. He's got some organizations already set up. He's got some ideas that sound right in line with what I'm thinking. I like it.
Absolutely. So I'm definitely so I've got it taken an action item to learn more about Alan's organization and see if we can't throw some weight behind it from Coffee Party. But right now we're going to go to 931. 931, your mic is open. Who do we have the pleasure of speaking with?
Hello, this is Bud Fields, otherwise known as the Tennessee Progressive, the host of
Bud
Progressive Politics.
Fields.
Tennessee Style. How are you?
Oh, I am so glad you called in because I'm sitting here going, well, I know there's a new guy, and I know it's a new show, and I don't have any of the details, and how am I supposed to plug a show if I don't? So I'm so glad you called in. Welcome to Press One for Democracy, and welcome to Coffee Party Radio.
Thank you very much.
You're very welcome. Can you give us a kind of a 10,000-foot overview about your show, kind of what your goal is, what your take on things are and how you do things so that
sure.
So our listeners can learn about our newest Coffee Party show.
Sure, be glad to, and thank you for the opportunity.
My pleasure.
Progressive Politics Tennessee Style, or as it's better known by most as PPTS, is a show that highlights the activities, activists, and activism across the progressive movement in America. We started 2 years ago after a conversation on the Daily Kos where the South was being vilified at every turn, and I got involved involuntarily in that conversation, and what came out of it, the nut that took hold was, if the progressives and Democrats in the South are doing anything, we're not hearing about it. Well, we don't know that they're doing anything. We don't know that they're moving forward the agenda, and I said, okay, so let's give them a voice. And we started in our first part of our first year trying work to highlight the progressive activities of the southern United States from Virginia over to and including Arizona and New Mexico. And we found out rather quickly that we were being heard several thousand times a week by people from all across the country who were trying hard to figure out ways to answer the question we ask at the end of every show, and that's, what are you going to do about it? And we generate invitations for people to come and converse about different sides of particular issues in conversation so that we can come up with solutions that will at least answer that question, hopefully with every show. Sometimes it takes more than one show to do that. And we've had special guests from, local activists who want to get a city ordinance, to Bill Baird, who was the guy that filed the Supreme Court cases, five of them, beginning with Baird v. Eisenstadt and went through Lawrence, Texas v. Lawrence, which basically gave birth control to America. Two of his cases are those upon which Roe v. Wade stands. And from every area of the country, we've been able to expand our show to include a larger progressive movement. Our primary purpose is to engage conversation among citizens in this country, regardless of your party or your political ideology. You know, we try to understand why someone will have a particular view on subject X and counter-argue that so that we might get a broader understanding of what the real topic is or what the real intent is, And we do that every Sunday afternoon now on the Coffee Party USA Network, beginning at 2 p.m. Central Time, which is 3 p.m. Eastern Time or noon Pacific. And those shows are rebroadcast throughout the week on other networks, including Netroots Radio, which does our rebroadcast on Tuesday evenings beginning at 9 p.m. Pacific Time. And we encourage people to participate not only in the show but in democracy. So that's what we do. And the way we go about it is kind of, I know you won't understand or agree with this, but we kind of believe that if we can set aside party affiliation and the color of the bumper sticker and talk together as citizens, we find that about 95% of the time we agree. What are we willing to give up for what we can get? And how do we compromise to move ahead the way we used to? If we can't heal the divide, at least create collateral conversational circulation that will result in us sending our electeds instructions on what we intend for them to do. And then we try to empower people to do that. And that's the whole function of the show.
That sounds very Coffee Party-esque, so I can see why why Eric was encouraged and excited to have you join the Coffee Party Radio family. So those are the same questions we ask on this show all the time. Those are the same philosophies we espouse here. I know you just heard me talk about it, this idea of we've got to call a truce, even if it's just temporary, so that we can get the things done that we all agree on, like the 80% of us that want to raise the minimum wage. That's a hot topic on your list. It's a very progressive idea.
We're working right now on a continuing series. It's going to last a while. It's based around the war on the poor. That includes a battle against women and a battle against hunger and a battle against education and a battle against the minimum wage and a battle against criminal justice and a battle against social justice. And we're trying to highlight specifics of those issues that, when combined, we can find out several things. What is it? Who's doing it? Why are they doing it? What do they have to stand from it? What do we have to lose from it or gain from it? And is it worthwhile? And what we've seen is that people are, as you may well imagine, given the subject topic of your show tonight, not aware of a lot of it. And when other callers tell other callers truth, the magic happens. And all of a sudden, the other mantra of our show is, when you speak truth to power, things change and allow you to become the change you seek. It's been a very pleasant experience to kind of stand witness to that, to find some faith that I was in danger of losing, personally. Maybe America doesn't care. Maybe democracy will die. Maybe we will replace it with the plutocratic corporatist theocracy that so many seem to say they want, until, of course, you tell them exactly what that means. And then they start having issues and questions with it.
I was going to say, I'm not familiar with, other than the people at the top who would benefit from such an arrangement, I'm not familiar with a lot of other people that say, yeah, that's what I want. I want corporations running America.
Those are the same people that vote against their own self-interest in pretty much anything else, including voter suppression, ID laws, and things like that, until you say, but wait a minute, I think we have too much government. And we've got to, reduce government to a size that we can drag it into the bathroom. And I said, yeah, but remember what else he said. He also wants to drown it in a bathtub. That's not changing government. That's removing government. And that means, remember that student loan you got? That mortgage that you got? Those are government, too. And as people in the shutdown saw, wow, it didn't take very long for their government to start impacting their existence where they live. And we try to get people involved within 12 blocks of where they live. We figure if we can do that, we had it made. And people are responding positively to the show, not necessarily in agreement, but with appreciation for the fact that the truth is coming out. And then they get to make different decisions. So that's what PPTS is all about. And having been a Coffee Party member since its origination, I found it to be a natural fit for me because what the party espouses is exactly what I believe and have been raised and have lived my life in both politics and in my personal life pursuing. So I'm glad to be here. It's very nice to be with the party and Eric and Annabelle and all those friends. And I look forward to it.
So maybe you could share on just on the topic we're talking about tonight on the TPP, where the progressives stand as far as the TPP is concerned.
Well, I'm not a spokesman for the progressives, but I think that the stuff that I've been able to find out about it is concerned, for instance, by the AFL-CIO, who talks about the TPP being negotiated by corporations, which, of course, brings me to one of my favorite topics, which is the American Legislative Exchange Council and the State House influence that they have over creating statewide legislation that somehow bubbles up to federalism without even being talked about.
Yeah, and in case you missed that, listeners, that is the group known as ALEC, who loves to write legislation and hand it to congressmen and say, here's a big check, go pass this.
That's correct, and they do that. And when I started looking at TPP and saw that 600 corporate members were involved in the negotiation of these sections of this bill, and then, of course, I fought hard for the elimination of SOPA and PIPA, because I happen to be an Internet business owner as well and understood what some of the ramifications of that were, I started listening to a little bit more of my union brothers and sisters who talked about, but wait a minute, there's no guarantee of any kind of labor participation, wages, benefits, involvement on the manufacturing side as far as quality. What is all this? Are corporations going to come down and the executives going to run the floor? Or are we going to lose things like minimum wage or the 40-hour work week? Well, potentially you could. Or you would have to compete against those countries that don't have those things, as we found out since NAFTA and some of the other trade agreements that have gone into place. And it portends, as far as I'm concerned, a clear path around the 99%. And I believe as an American citizen, that's not exactly the way I want my America to be run. And I certainly don't want to run it that way. So I'm very interested in removing the option of fast track. I believe that Congress should take a look at it. I've seen letters from 230 congressmen and congresswomen requesting the removal of fast track status possibility from this trade agreement. There's a lot of concern about the lack of transparency that is only echoed by Senator Warren. It did not originate with her. It was brought to her attention, and her response was entirely her own. It was authentic. It was genuine, as pretty much everything is with her, and that's what people listen to. I find it on my show. I think you find it on yours. People listen to reality, not necessarily agree with it, but they do listen to it. And when they hear the stuff across the TV and all that stuff where one has a bias on one side or the other, they tune it out. And that's why a lot of people are not being really well informed on TPP right now, because there's what talk there is seems to be rather biased one way or the other.
I don't really see a lot of it, to be honest with you. And I think, I mean, the conclusion I've drawn is that this follows the line of basically the way that things have been retooled to work. And that is, you know, the media used to care about consumers and who they're selling to. Now they've been bought out by these huge corporations. I think the stat was something like 98% of the media outlets in this country are controlled by six companies. And so now they can control the conversation, not for the purpose of selling product, which is what it used to be, but for the purpose of promoting their corporate masters' wills and whims. And so they've just become part of the conspiracy that is Washington, big corporations, and now the media. And so they're all colluding. And so you only hear about what they want you to hear about. And instead of talking about these substantive issues like the TPP, like raising minimum wage, like the fact that 90% of Americans were for gun background checks on gun owners, that 80% of Americans are against Citizens United and want a legislative fix to it, those kinds of things. You don't hear about those things because that's not what their masters want you to hear. So what they want you to hear is they want to talk about this guy's going to take your gun away, so don't vote for him. Yeah, but he's forget, you know, and they ignore the fact that that's the guy that wants to promote the progressive agenda that's going to get you back to work and that's going to get your town's economy rolling. But they are able to do things by saying, yeah, but he's going to take your gun away and he's going to he's pro choice and we can't put those murderers in there, can we? And you know, and they go to these divisive issues and they sell them. And then my father said the same thing. People vote their pocketbook. You can talk about all the issues. People vote their pocketbook. It's not so anymore. It's just not so.
It's because so many people don't have pocketbooks anymore.
well, you think they want to get
the reality of Citizens United was not that all of a sudden corporations began participating in the political process. It was that they no longer had a reason to hide it. And what we've seen since Citizen United is not new stuff. It is, I think that is the shock and awe that most Americans are feeling these days when they look at everything from ultra-moderate Republican politics to, I have a special name for Tea Party politics that I won't use on your show, but these people are brazen about it. Not only are we doing it, but you can't do anything about it. And we can suppress as many votes as we choose to, and there's nothing you can do about it. It's much easier for us to spend what for us is not even a drop in the bucket, which would be more than your entire House rep or state Senate campaign, to make sure you don't have airtime. So as much as they're promoting an agenda or an issue or a side of an issue, they can also afford to suppress any other conversation about it by taking away the airtime from other people. And there's only so much airtime in a day. Excuse me. There's only so much airtime in a day. And when these things happen, they can also go where their power is the greatest. And that is at the state house level. The closer to you the politics lie, the more they impact your life. And that's how they come up with 37 ultimately red state houses that can either make sure an amendment to a constitution, for instance, passes or doesn't. That's where the money has gone. You know, they spent just tons of money in this last election. We didn't see nearly enough of it to account for it. Where did that all go? The answer is it went to state house races. It went to state house legislation. It went to those issues and agencies that can affect daily life by passing model bills from their quarterly conferences to their selected chosen leadership in the conservative side and ensuring that they get into legislative form without so much as the first citizen's comment. And that's what I have a disagreement with.
Yeah, and that seems to be the exact course of the TPP.
I have the same view toward the TPP. Why are we, well, of course, I would ask, why are we allowing corporations to have anything to do with the United States Trade Agreement? But more importantly, why are we not allowing citizens to see the work as it develops or at least have a reasonable understanding of what it is that the intent of the partnership is? And there's enough in the partnership that we do know about before WikiLeaks released another load of it on Wednesday that I just found out about as I was listening to your show, by the way, that should make us all think twice. And to contact our congressman and demand transparency, I think that's fair. I really do. And in this case, there are some things we need not know. How many troops we have on the border is one of those things that we really need not know. Whether or not we're going to eliminate the possibility of creating manufacturing jobs because we're going to outsource our entire economy to somebody else is something I think we should know. These are national level issues.
Yep. No, we're absolutely in total lockstep agreement here. And I honestly don't know that writing your congressman is the right play here, only because so many of them have espoused frustration about not getting to know. I mean, you know, one of the great quotes I loved, he said, hustling back and looking for the exact quote he wanted to talk about, came from...
definitely, although...
thank you. Came from Alan Grayson, who is a progressive Democratic representative from the 9th District in Florida. And he said, having seen what I've seen, I would characterize this as a gross abrogation of American sovereignty, talking about the fact that companies, foreign companies, would be able to appeal to international tribunals for relief from what American businesses would still have to follow because they're governed by American laws. And he said he further characterized it as a punch in the face to the middle class. He said, I think that's fair to say from what I've seen, but I'm not allowed to tell you why. So these people, there's these stories over and over again. You can find them just, you know, simple Google searches where these people, it takes months and months and months to finally gain access. They're only given pieces, parts of it that affect them. So, like, you know, if you're on a committee that oversights intellectual property rights and those kinds of things, you can see that piece. But then what they said is, oh, but this is all covered under the, you know, Confidential Information Act, so you can't talk about it.
Right.
So it's like the Congress people aren't even getting what they want. So I'm sorry, but I think we need...
And it may not even be current because they may not even be current because these versions are coming out at a fast clip. And one of the things I wanted to highlight that maybe people could take an interest to look at was you were talking about being on a committee. If you're on the Finance Committee, you know, there seems to be a bubbling up of extreme interest on the parts of many of the members of the Finance Committee over sections of the proposed TPP that deal with the international regulation of all currency. There is a lot of discussion about that on finance forums and things like that, which is where I thought I would hear about it through intellectual property, and I didn't. I heard about it through finance. Where they're talking about regulating American currency on an international scale. And I have a problem with that because I think that kind of needs to be confined within the constraints or the boundaries of the United States of America, being, you know, the radical I am. But there are evidently a large swath of concerns in very different arenas, from finance to pharmaceuticals to manufacturing to labor to education to... Is this a big deal? And
no, absolutely. And, you know, to your point,
a lot of
And to your point, the tribunals that I was referring to, the international tribunals, come under the auspices of a group called the International Center for Settlement of Investment Disputes. And
cool.
Guess what they are a subset of? The World Bank.
I couldn't imagine. Oh, really?
Yeah.
Those are the people that housed the hedge fund managers that left the United States after the American meltdown to go do the same thing in Europe. That would be interesting, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
I wonder what Diamond would have to say to them. Probably go, boys, go. Well, I was grateful to have the invite, and I was grateful to get the email, and it's a particular pleasure to meet you. And I think that I'm very grateful that you gave me the opportunity to speak about the show on the new site. And I look very much forward to seeing us progress, learn, grow, and share together on Coffee Party USA.
I do as well. And you forgive my – and it's the last time I'll have to ask you, because I'm embarrassed to have to ask you this, but I only got to type Bud in there. So
Fields, F-I-E-L-D-S.
Bud Fields.
Fields, uh-huh.
Okay, beautiful. Bud Fields. So, and one more time, the name of your show?
Progressive Politics, Tennessee Style, which means we're going to cut you to the bone, but we're going to make it easy on you. We'll be nice about it. We'll give you all day to tell us no.
Yeah, and then you're going to serve us up some good barbecue.
Oh, you betcha. With sweet tea and lemon. Right out here on the front porch.
There you go. So that's 2 p.m. Central Time, 3 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, and noon out here on the West Coast on Sundays. Brand new Coffee Party Radio Show. Thank you so much for joining us, Bud.
Sure. Thank you for allowing me, and I look forward.
Nope, and I what a horrible host I have. I cut you off there at the end.
Hey, that's okay. I just wanted to say thanks.
My apologies and my pleasure. You're welcome anytime. Thanks
much.
I'll
talk to you next time. Bye-bye for now.
All right. So, Greg, Mr. Silent Sam, what do you think of Mr. Fields and his new show?
You know what? I wanted to I was hoping you'd leave his mic open. I wanted to tell him that I thought he did a really great job on Saturday pinch hitting for Egberto.
Ah, I didn't know that. And unfortunately, I would open it up again, but he's left the show. So,
okay. Well, he'll hear it on a rebroadcast.
So you'll have to call. You can call in on Sunday at 2 p.m. Central Time and let him know.
It looks like he's still in the chat room too. And I was going to ask him. I thought Tennessee was famous for a different drink than sweet tea, but that's maybe a conversation for another time too.
Well, good lemon.
No, I'm thinking more something a little stronger, a little more adult beverage oriented.
Yeah,
never mind.
Lynchburg lemonade.
We're
talking Jack Daniels, right?
Yeah, yeah, I think that's one. Yeah,
Lynchburg lemonade for those of us who can't drink Jack straight up. I will admit I'm not a brown liquor guy. I'm more of a beer guy, which is one of the reasons why I'm in Portland. But yeah, Lynchburg lemonade. That's a nice, refreshing summer drink. It's a beautiful
yes,
thing.
Yes, it is. He actually, you guys brought up a couple of topics. I took a couple of quick notes that I think are probably worth reinforcing. And it is about awareness in the populace. And it struck me as I was listening to you guys talk that I think, and I'm no expert on this, but I think there was a time in our country when news operations within broadcasting were kept separate and apart from the entertainment, and they weren't expected to be profit centers. They were performing a public service. They took their responsibility as the fourth estate seriously. And so, you know, I'm not that old that I can remember, you know, Edward R. Murrow. I have vague memories of Walter Cronkite and all those guys. But it does seem like what has happened is that the news operations, and this is across the board. This isn't just limited to mainstream, you know, network television. This isn't limited to Fox. This is everybody, with some very rare exceptions like this, where the news operations are expected to generate eyeballs and generate revenues for that operation. And I think that is a big part of what has corrupted and allowed so much of the populace to become not just ill-informed, but misinformed. And you know who that, I think, is the guilty party there, and that's Fox. Fox might be the most popular, quote-unquote, news source in America, but the good news is I shouldn't say it this way, the demographic is dying off. You know, they're big with the 65 and over white crowd. Pretty soon, they're going to have less and less influence over America, but something's going to have to take its place. And what I don't really see, although, you know, I'm certainly a liberal, I admit that, I'm a progressive, and I admit that, and I lean left, and I admit that. But I'm not the guy who sits in front of Rachel Maddow and Ed Schultz and Lawrence O'Donnell every night. I can't remember the last time I watched any one of those three. There's a missing element in our society today, and it's information. That's, I think, is a huge problem that we have, and it's because, again, I think it's all about, in a 24/7 cycle, salaciousness sells, and that's what they're going to put on. It takes time to develop and digest and understand what the Trans-Pacific Partnership even is, let alone what you should maybe be concerned about, and then what you should do about it. It takes time, and most people won't dedicate that kind of time to it.
And I will admit that I was a... I used to be strictly a broadcast guy. I listened to radio. I would watch television. But I was of that, you know, 30 to 1 minute, you know, give it to me in a minute, and then let me be done.
Yeah.
And Then my wife smacked me upside the back of the head enough and said, you've got to read Time. She said, Time is the one last publication that she believes is fair, and I believe it is as well. They have both liberal and conservative writers. They put out both sides of the argument. They don't try to settle it for you. I think they do a phenomenal job. But print journalism, where you have the ability to go in depth and get the, you know, five-page write-up. You can't sit there and read five pages of script on a news story. You've just lost your audience. You probably lost your audience at the end of page one. That's probably about it, right? So I think it's important. And, you know, the fact of the matter is that I started this morning. I got up at like 5:30 because I was all excited, and I just started Googling TPP. And I mean, it only took me about an hour to put together enough what I would call damning evidence to shoot this thing down and to fill up a two-hour show. It does not take long, but you're right. You have to be willing to invest the time. Now, I have to go back and do the fair and balanced thing because somebody's got to, because we know Fox doesn't, right? But here's the thing. I think it's not about anything other than towing the company line anymore. Right? It's like, you know as well as I do, you work for a big corporation and you start speaking out regularly against the direction the company's going in, if it's especially like, oh, that CEO, what does he know, blah, blah, blah. I mean, you're going to hit the streets pretty fast. You know what? Just as fast as people get fired from Fox for not towing the company line, what about Juan Williams getting fired from NPR for daring to speak out, daring to speak the truth? He didn't tow the company line. Blam, he's gone. And that guy is as progressive and as liberal as it gets as a media person. But NPR just dropped him because he dared to speak. He dared to not toe the company line. So I don't think it's a matter of whether it's Fox doing this or any. It's just a matter of it's no longer about what you said. It's not about journalistic integrity. It's not about informing the public. It's not about getting to the bottom of it. I mean, I think probably Woodward and Bernstein were the last two reporters that actually said, this is important. And it wasn't because they were liberals and wanted to get Nixon. They wanted to get at the bottom of the truth of a real news story and inform America. And they did it. And, you know, and the funny thing is, of course, as we all know about Watergate, is it was his second election. He won by a landslide. He would have won even if they hadn't gone in there and done that stuff that they did. But it was just that we exposed a criminal at the highest levels. And that mattered for something. Now it's about exposing the governor of South Carolina for going down to South America and having an affair with his mistress. You know what? Bill Clinton already the whole Clinton, you know, debacle decided that we don't care anymore about that stuff. Find out how he's embezzling money from the South Carolina Treasury. Now that's a story. But they don't care about that.
Well, that takes,
it doesn't
again,
matter.
You're talking about the distinction between something that everybody understands immediately, just like you talked about earlier, the divisive social issues, which are no less important than, in my mind, you know, things like economic policy, foreign policy. Those social issues are important because people are affected by them, and we should never forget that. But those are the issues that people actually understand, or at least believe they do, immediately. If you're going to have a debate with somebody who doesn't even know what the letters TPP stand for about what should and shouldn't be part of a trade agreement and how it ought to be derived and what it ought to include and those kinds of things, well, you're a long way from having a meaningful conversation if you spent an hour and a half this morning taking the time to educate yourself on it and someone who is saying that, I don't know, taking some sort of an opposing stance as to, you know, all trade is good trade, you don't know what you're talking about when, you know what I'm trying to say?
Here's what it boils down to. It's real simple, Greg. It's faith versus fact. You cannot argue against a person's faith, right? All trade is good. The only way you could accept that is on faith. You know, you found in a heartbeat. An article that says no, here's proof that's not true. Oh yeah, it is. And that's when you start getting all the fallacies that flow into logic, right? You get the ad hominem. I'm just going
right.
to attack Greg, and by nullifying
right.
Greg, I nullify anything that comes out of his mouth.
That's
you,
right.
you get that
right.
kind of crap. You know, you get
right.
the, oh, yeah, but they do it too argument, as if that,
yes.
you know, as the two
theory.
Wrongs make a right all of a sudden.
Yeah.
You get all
yeah.
the, you get all that crap, be,
right.
And it's because people are arguing from a standpoint of faith and, to a point, ignorance, and you're coming with the facts and trying to enlighten them. And the TBP, we can it's fact. There's plenty of facts behind this that, if, you know, you can argue. But, you know, when does life begin? At conception, at 5 weeks, at 10 weeks, at 20 weeks, we don't know. We can guess, but you know what? Unfortunately, you can't interview a fetus just after it's born, going, "Excuse me, but when exactly were you alive?" There's no answer to that question, and so therefore, people can just say what they want, and you can't argue that with them. You know, gay marriage is marriage between a man or a woman, or is marriage can be between a woman, a man, and a man. Yeah, that, you can't argue. It's faith. It's a
right.
personal belief.
Right. No, I made that.
Those
I made
are the things.
I,
it's not that I'm saying they're not important. I'm just saying that we need to prioritize. And people, you need to live. What good is having freedom of choice if you can't feed yourself every day? What good is having the ability to marry the same-sex person if the two of you are living under a bridge because you can't get work? I mean, we need to prioritize. I don't want to diminish them or minimize them. Those are important issues, but we got to prioritize.
Well, I like to believe that most people are capable of handling and maybe holding more than one thought at a time, and that's why I try not to allow for anyone to lose sight of the fact that if we're going to work together, we also have to be working together on things like social issues. They can't be taking a back seat, because they'll be in the back seat forever. And if while we're working on our common ground together, if more people, and Bud made this point, and I make this point all the time too, it never ceases to amaze me how so many people can be so willful in their ignorance to continue to vote against their own economic self-interest. It's astounding to me. But those are also the same people who are, in a lot of cases, also going to be, in my opinion, on the absolute wrong side of these social issues. So there's already two strikes going against us. For me, I consider this like part of my responsibility in life, is to try and bring to light to those folks who don't see it yet the fallacy of their beliefs. And that's a hard thing to do. I made this point with Egberto several weeks ago on his show. You can change people's opinions, but you can almost never change their beliefs. And that's the hard part. And so much of what is wrong with the dysfunction in our country today is that so much of it is rooted in belief systems that are just, they're not just counterproductive from an economic standpoint, they're counterproductive from a social standpoint. Why should anybody care who somebody else marries? I mean, what business is it of anybody else's? You know, that if those folks can't get past that, how are they going to? I don't know. Maybe I'm connecting the dots too liberally here, but how are they going to jump on board with the idea that a trade agreement that's going to continue to funnel more jobs to the lowest cost marketplace is a bad idea?
Again, one has facts behind it and one has precedents behind it, right? So we can point to NAFTA and we can point to the thousands and thousands and tens of thousands and hundreds of thousands of jobs that were lost to NAFTA, you know?
Right.
But here's the thing. When you talk to somebody about that, I'll give you a perfect example. So, and this is something I got from Joseph Stiglitz's book, The Price of Inequality, which is, again, if you want to read a great definitive and very scholastic, because he is a professor of economics, he's a Nobel Prize winner, and he writes very scholastically, so it took me a long time to get through his book, but it was worth the read.
Easier one to read, Reich's Aftershock.
Okay. Yeah, I know. I definitely have to get up on some of his stuff. I really like, obviously, he's...
So go ahead, I'm sorry.
He's much more pragmatic, I think, than Stiglitz is. But the point is that after the collapse of Detroit, after the big three almost went belly up, or were headed towards belly up, and the federal government came in with cash for clunkers and, you know, basically loaned them enough money so that they could survive, right? But what was the aftermath of that? And the aftermath of that was that I have to speak in approximations because I don't have the exact numbers in front of me, but what was a like $15.50 entry level job at an automaking plant is now a $9.80 job at an automaking plant, and it's, you know, people were forced to take wage cuts, unions were very much disabled, they took a lot of the bargaining power. They were said, you will take this deal. Or we won't bail you out and you'll be out of a job. The administration was very heavy-handed in the way they quote-unquote saved Detroit. But people will then say, well, but I even though they're making $9 instead of $15, shouldn't they be happy just because they're working?
Yeah. Right.
Now multiply that by the 1.6 million Americans who had middle-wage jobs who are now working at fast food restaurants and in shipping plants and packaging plants making minimum wage, just so they can put food on their table and keep a roof over their family's heads. And you're just going to tell them that's the answer? Hey, well, you should be happy. And now we get the TPP, which is going to mean more competition from low-cost labor sources. So next, what's next? Oh, you should be happy you're making $6 an hour? Well, people in China make 50 cents an hour. You should be happy. And that's the sickness to me. And I do mean sickness. That, to me, is a disease that has swept over America. Well, it's actually two diseases. It's the disease of the rich, who I believe are just totally without conscience, and that the whole idea of I just don't care about anybody but my bank account. And it's the disease of the complacency is a disease, too, of what we're willing to accept. And we've just been willing to accept this downward spiral. Well, the 98% have been willing to accept this downward spiral for 30 years. Just waiting. Oh, we'll get ours.
Yes, right.
No,
right.
We won't. Right. We'll get what we take. And it's time to take back Washington and get back our government and level the playing field. And, you know, I am not a progressive at heart, but we need at least 20 or 30 years of a progressive movement to level the playing field. And then once we get to level and we learn to live together and work together and we get this income and wealth disparity down to a manageable level or a reasonable level, I guess I should say, then we can talk about easing up and looking at ways to grow, but making sure that all boats have the opportunity to rise with the tide and people aren't getting left behind. That's my theory.
Well, and I think for the most part I'm in agreement with it. I tend to be probably a little bit more to the left when it comes to what is often referred to pejoratively as an activist government. That doesn't mean that they're creeping into your bedrooms and telling you who you can marry and who you can have relationships with, by the way. What that means is they ensure that the market doesn't operate in such a way that too few benefit while too many suffer. That's the definition of an activist government, in my mind. And so this notion that, you know, we as individuals, as citizens, need to stop voting against our own economic self-interests. Now, we don't have very many good choices today, I will admit that. There are precious few legislators today, especially at the national level, that seem to understand these kinds of concepts, and I think we all know that short list of names at this point. You like your senators, and there's a couple in the Northeast that are doing some pretty good work, but beyond that, it's hard to name any more names. Until our fellow citizens get their heads out of their collective behind on some of these issues, it's going to be a hard slog.
Well, we actually have one calling from area code 319, and I'm opening your mic, 319. Tell us where your head's at, and but before you do that, tell us who you are and where you're calling from.
Well, my name is Richard Gates. I'm from Keokuk, Iowa.
Richard
and
Gates.
I've been listening to you. Yes, go ahead.
No, you said from Keokuk?
Yes.
Oh, okay. Welcome to the show.
Thank you.
But,
yeah, I'm kind of confused. You guys got kind of a Tea Party label, and you're talking a lot of stuff that's completely against any of the conservative grassroots movement.
Hold on a second. I'm curious. You said we have a Tea Party kind of label?
TPP? That would indicate that you're associated with Tea Party patriots from...
Let me straighten that confusion out. We're talking about the Trans-Pacific Partnership, the trade agreement that's being negotiated by the president and 600 corporate consultants that has been done in total secrecy from the American people. We're not talking about the Tea Party patriots. Although I will say, in one of the groups that Greg and I are both active in, the New York Tea Party patriots are also in the same exact boat as we are in wanting to get money out of government, and so that's the Represent Us group and the Anti-American Corruption Act. So we try not to do labels here. I mean, what I believe in, my policy is monikers only, right? So a moniker is a nickname you give yourself. So if you want to self-identify in a certain group, that's great. But we try not to put labels on people.
Okay.
So
I can appreciate that. So what do you think about amending the Constitution to restrict government?
To restrict government? In what way?
In every way. Term limits, giving states back the authority over the federal government.
Well, I'm term limits I think is a good idea. I certainly think it would help reduce the corruption in government. You have to go, if you're a lobbyist, you have to go shopping, you know, every couple of terms in order to buy new ones, right? So I think that's a good thing. As far as giving the states more rights, I would not disagree with that, and I'll tell you where I think I'd like to give the states rights to. I'd like to give the states rights to all the social issues. I'd like to see things like gay marriage, right of choice, women's right to choose, gun control, those kinds of things. I'd like to see a lot of those things decided at the state level because they're what I call tribal issues to me. Because we're a huge country, right? And every American, you can't say an American or every American and mean anything, right? I mean, people are different and they settle in different parts of the country. And they have different cultures, and I think certain of those things are cultural issues, and I'd like to see a lot of those things go back to the state level, if for no other reason than to clear the air of them at the national level, and let's focus on things that the national government should be focusing on, and not, you know, like, get out of my bedroom, national government. Don't tell me what to do in my bedroom. I don't want that, you know. But
well,
get out,
I agree with that, but I'd like to go back to something you said just a second ago. About gun rights. I mean, that's a constitutional right guaranteed under the Bill of Rights.
Well, I agree with you.
Do you think
that's a state issue? I'm certain gun rights. So, like, let's talk about background checks. The Constitution says you have the right to bear arms, but it doesn't say that if you are mentally ill, you have the right to bear arms. And the fact of the matter is that speech is controllable.
It says that the right to bear arms shall not be infringed.
Yeah, but it also says the right to free speech shall not be infringed, correct?
Absolutely.
Okay, can you yell fire in a crowded theater? No, you
can't.
You can
burn a flag.
But you can't yell fire in a theater. There are precedents that have been set that say no. Speech is not 100% free. There are certain things you cannot say because you endanger the lives of other people. Kids under the age of 18 can't wear swastikas to school. They don't have their kids under the age of 18 have limited speech. So there has been so no right is absolute in this country. No right is.
Well, you know, if you look back at what the founders said, they said that our liberties and the basis of law is to ensure equal liberty. So, in other words, your liberty does not expand beyond what would impose on somebody else's freedom.
Well, right, and that's the old adage: the right for me to swing my fist stops at the edge of your nose.
Oh yeah, okay.
I think it's horrific, and this is where Greg and I need our good friend Bobby Rodrigo, who is very much involved in the PANDA, the People Against the NDAA, and I rail constantly on this show about how the federal government has ratcheted down on our civil rights and our civil liberties and in horrible ways, unspeakable ways, NSA snooping. Get out of my email. Get off my phone line. You know, if you don't have probable cause and you can't get a warrant to tap my phone line, get away from me. You know, yeah, believe me. Oh, I'm 100% in your corner on those things. But we do have, and we have decided, that we are a society in certain instances, and we're individuals in other instances. And as a society, we choose to do collective things. Sewers, the power grid, police, fire people. There are certain things, building roads, airports and running airlines. There are certain things that are in the benefit of the whole. And in certain instances, you do. As a member of the society that is benefiting from those things, you have to pay the piper. You have to.
Are all of these things that you mentioned in the enumerated powers in the Constitution?
They are as of the 17th Amendment.
Are they in the Constitution? The 17th Amendment only changed the way we elect our senators.
Oh, I'm sorry. My bad. Okay, so I always get these wrong. Which is the one that says that Congress can affect an income tax? That changed the whole game.
That's the 16th Amendment.
Okay, thank you. I apologize for getting the number wrong, but that's the one that changed the whole game. That's the one that said Congress can levy taxes and do good for the collective good. Because originally it was only for protection of the country, right? You could only levy taxes to protect the country. Yeah. We needed to go beyond that because as a society we decided that together we are greater. We are greater than the sum of the parts. A whole is greater than the sum of the parts. We could do, and look at what we've accomplished. Look at the power grid. Look at sewers, roads. Look at the space program and all of the scientific benefits that we've gotten from that. We have done so much good as a collective society, and that's what the government's supposed to be doing, and that's my beef. I don't want small government. I don't want big government. I want good government. And to me, good government is doing what's best for the people, not for the corporations who own them now. And that is our big fight. That's the problem. The people in Washington don't care what you and I think. They don't give a rat's behind about us. I can't write a check with enough zeros to make them pay attention to me.
Okay, so here's the 16th Amendment. The Congress shall have the power to lay and collect taxes on incomes from whatever source derived, without apportionment among the several states and without regard to the census or enumeration. It doesn't say anything about social values. It doesn't say anything about economic values. It just says the government can take whatever it wants. That's the 16th Amendment, sir. I just read it to you straight from the Constitution.
Yes.
So
I think that
we do need a limited government so that we can make sure that we don't have the NSA bugging our phones and our emails. We've got to get people out of Washington, D.C. that are just seeking more political power, more economic wealth for themselves. That's what we've got to do because we've become almost a police state with the red light cameras and all the other stuff. And then we have lost our political power as individuals because we've got lobbyists and corporate entities that are entering into the Washington area, and they're saying, well, you know what, I'm going to get $1 million from company XYZ, and Joe Blow, my constituent, is only going to give me $10 this week. So,
And there you go, Richard. You have just proved what I have been saying for the last, well, ever since I've been on the air. So, you're a person that believes in less government. I believe in good government, which. So I it could be as big as it wants. To me, as long as it's effective and it's not infringing on my rights and wasting my money, I'm all for it. But so we have a little bit different ideas there. But you and I agree on one thing. Until we chase the money out of Washington, D.C., nothing's going to change. And so let's agree to not worry about big versus small or left versus right, and let's get together and let's get the corporate money out of Washington, and let's retake the government for you and me, so that when you and I have this discussion, it actually matters.
And then you and I, as reasonable people,
can get to a point where we agree on the right size of government. And I love that. I'm glad to have that conversation with you every Monday, starting at 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Love it.
All right. Well, it was a good conversation. I will still make the point that I believe that less government is better, because we need to get the government out of our pocket too. Because you've got all these entitlements, we've got all this national debt, and as long as we got a big government, you're going to have a problem with coercion. Thomas Jefferson said that he could see the end of this republic. First, by consolidation of power, and then by the necessary
I wish I could finish the quote for you. I'm not familiar. Greg, any help?
No, I'm sorry, I don't know that one.
Right.
Okay, it was the necessary. It's not coercion.
Collusion. I don't know. I'm just guessing now. But I'll tell you what, Richard, why don't you come on back next Monday, and let's have some more good discussion, and then you can give us the exact quote.
All right. I'll do that.
All right. Thanks, Richard. Appreciate it. Richard Gates checking in. We've got exactly, let's see, what does my little ticker here say? 3 minutes and 58 seconds left in the show. Boy, it's been a fun one, Greg. I appreciate you riding along and saving me from having to talk, and I'm glad we finally got some good discussion out of it, and it was more than just moi. There is no doubt that this TPP thing, we at least need to shine the lights on it, because I like what Ross Perot said when he ran for president. He goes, I'm going to take the cameras with me. Let me see if I can do my Perot. I'm going to take the cameras with me. And you know what happens with cameras? You need bright lights. And you know what happens when you turn on bright lights? Cockroaches go scurrying for the corners. And that's exactly what we need to do. We need to shine the brightest lights possible on the corridors of power of Washington, D.C., get the cockroaches scurry to the corners, and get everything out in daylight, you know, and so everybody can see, and at least that way we can have a reasonable discussion. But and then we can do what Elizabeth Warren said, which is, hey, we can participate in our democracy. That would be nice,
right.
Wouldn't it?
Right.
Thank you, Greg Russick, for hanging out. Thank you, everybody who hung out. Thank you, Bud Fields, our newest Coffee Party radio star. And this is Dan Aronson. It has been another wonderful P1FD, Press One for Democracy. And if you have any comments about the show, please feel free to forward them to me at p1fd@comcast.net. So, for me and Greg and all the rest of our wonderful Coffee Party participants, thank you, and in the mortal words of Janine, look at that, Janine Loudon, Coffee Party on.